From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this Memorial Day edition of Fresh Air, the story of one of the first big battles of Vietnam. The Battle of Ia Drang lasted 4 days. We'll talk to the general who led the battle and the journalist who risked his life to cover it. They both say it was the worst battle they've ever seen. Also today, one of our great war novelists, Tim O'Brien, remembers his experiences in Vietnam. And Maureen Corrigan reviews a novel set during World War I called A Very Long Engagement. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Memorial Day ceremonies have been held throughout the day in Washington, D.C. President Clinton has laid a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknowns in Arlington National Cemetery. He used the occasion to specially honor the veterans of World War II. The 50th anniversary of D-Day is June 6th. Other commemorations have been held as well. Republican Congressman Tom Ridge of Pennsylvania reminded visitors to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial that veterans from the Southeast Asian War must also be held in high honor.
In a few days, the world will turn its attention to the now tranquil French shores where heroic and gallant deeds took place. It is fitting, then, that we gather here in another place of honor reserved for those who also fought and died a generation later.
Congressman Tom Ridge of Pennsylvania. A senior congressional Democrat says if Dan Rostenkowski goes to trial, the proceedings could delay Congress's work on health care. New York Congressman Charles Rangel has told ABC if Rostenkowski is indicted on corruption charges, he would have to give up his chairmanship of the House Ways and Means Committee. Rangel predicts this would mean that it would take a little longer to get a health care bill passed. But Republican Congressman Rick Santorum of Pennsylvania says health care reform might actually be easier. He says without Rostenkowski, the Ways and Means Committee might be able to get a bipartisan coalition to agree on a health care plan. A gunman shot and missed former Japanese Prime Minister Morihiro Hosokawa today. The ex-premier was giving a speech at a Tokyo hotel. The BBC's Philip Short has this report.
The incident occurred as Mr. Hosokawa was about to leave a hotel in the Tokyo suburb of Shinjuku, where he'd been attending a meeting of his Japan New Party. Eyewitnesses say there was the sound of gunfire, and bodyguards surrounded the former Prime Minister and hurried him to his waiting car. According to police, 3 shots were fired, apparently into the air, and a man, identified as a right-wing extremist, was overpowered and arrested. No one was hurt. Mr. Hosokawa, who resigned last month, had infuriated right-wingers here by describing Japan's actions in Asia during the 1930s and 40s as a war of aggression. But it seems clear the attack was intended merely to intimidate and was not a serious attempt on Mr. Hosokawa's life.
Philip Short reporting. A published report says U.S. officials believe that invading Haiti wouldn't be a problem. But the New York Times says officials worry that an invading force could get bogged down in the Caribbean nation for years. The Congressional Research Service says that one of the problems with Haiti is that it has no history of successful self-government. President Clinton is relying on economic sanctions to force out Haiti's ruling military leaders. This is NPR. Russia says it's taken the United States off its list of nuclear targets. A Russian parliamentary leader made that announcement today. The Russian Foreign Ministry says the country's long-range nuclear missiles aren't aimed at the United States anymore, and that the United States has said it's not targeting Russia anymore. The Interfax news agency is quoting a senior Russian commander who says the missiles' guidance systems no longer have coordinates for U.S. targets. Leading German heart surgeons have rejected charges of widespread bribery in connection with operations to implant pacemakers. NPR's Dieter Berger reports from Frankfurt.
After a year of investigation, officials of the public health insurance system claim they have been swindled by numerous hospitals, which have systematically overcharged for pacemaker implantations. German hospitals were charging up to $4,000 to implant U.S.-manufactured pacemakers that normally cost under $1,000. Distributors paid some of the difference, they say, directly to heart surgeons. In addition, distributors often gave doctors free vacations and automobiles in return for an agreement to use their products. At a crisis meeting of the top insurance companies, officials say they fear they have been overcharged for a wide variety of other medical products. The damage could run into billions of dollars. I'm Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
The World Health Organization is warning that 10 million people a year will die from smoking within 30 years unless the spread of tobacco is stopped in developing nations. The WHO says young women particularly must be warned. The United Nations body is urging Asian and Latin American governments to ban cigarette advertising. It also suggests the governments outlaw tobacco sponsorship of sports and cultural events. The warning was issued in commemoration of the World Health Organization's World No Tobacco Day, which is observed tomorrow. The WHO says half of all Asian men smoke. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This is Memorial Day, the day on which we remember those who died in war. Today my guests are remembering a battle they were lucky enough to survive, the Battle of Ia Drang. It was the first major land battle the Americans fought in Vietnam. It was also the bloodiest. Both sides claimed victory. Both sides suffered tremendous losses. My guests are Lieutenant General Harold Moore, who led the campaign, and Joseph Galloway, who was a 23-year-old reporter at the time, covering the battle for UPI. General Moore led 450 men of the 1st Battalion, 7th Cavalry, into the Ia Drang Valley. They never expected to be surrounded by 2,000 North Vietnamese soldiers. Reinforcements came from both sides. The battle ended with 230 Americans dead, 240 wounded, and 3,000 North Vietnamese dead. General Moore is now retired. Joseph Galloway is a senior writer for U.S. News & World Report. They collaborated on the bestseller We Were Soldiers Once and Young, Ia Drang, the Battle That Changed the War in Vietnam. I spoke to them in November of 1992, just after the book was published, on the 27th anniversary of the battle. General Moore says the worst-case scenario happened early on in the battle when one of his platoons was cut off from the rest of the battalion.
That happened because we had a very aggressive lieutenant who was ordered to go up to the rest of the company through this scrub jungle and get on their flank and give them mutual support. In other words, tie in with them on their right flank. This lieutenant and his platoon encountered 3 to 4 North Vietnamese as they got to the rest of their company, and he ordered his men to take off after them, which they did. They got out 300 yards away from the rest of the company, away from everyone else, and were cut off, surrounded and cut off from the rest of the battalion.
What's your responsibility when that happens?
Quite simple. My responsibility was to try to get them back and get to them and keep them from being overrun. As it turned out, the platoon leader was killed within minutes. The next in command, the platoon sergeant, was killed. And command came down to a buck sergeant, 3 stripes, who took command of the platoon. And he formed them into a perimeter, brought in fire support, artillery and air, and we held this enemy off as we tried to attack to get to them. It took us over 24 hours to get to them. But when we got to them and rescued them, they still had ammunition with which to fight.
General, you weren't prepared for the size of the Vietnamese force that you faced. What were you prepared to find and how many men were actually there against you?
Okay. About 10 minutes before we took off for the Ia Drang Valley in the initial assault, I received information that there were 3 battalions of enemy, and a battalion of North Vietnamese is around 500 men, that there were 3 battalions of the enemy within 2 miles of our landing zone. And so I sifted this through my head and immediately realized that we could be into a fight almost immediately upon landing, and which indeed we were. Within 45 minutes, we were in the first major battle of the war between a large American force and North Vietnamese forces. I say large because eventually I got 3 or 4 hours later the rest of my battalion on the ground, but at first we only had 80 to 100. And it was a very, very sporty occasion, let me assure you.
Joe Galloway, I'm going to ask you to describe what it was like to be on the ground in the middle of a battle in which there was rocket fire, bombs, cannons, ground artillery.
This was shocking. This was overwhelming noise. You couldn't hear yourself think. The second morning, the enemy launched a major attack on the southeast side of this little football-sized clearing. And all of a sudden, this thunderous attack erupts, and we're right behind the company that's being hit. And the machine gun fire and the rifle fire and the rocket grenades of the enemy that pass through that company are landing on us. Men next to me fell over with a bullet in the head. I was lying down as close to the ground as I could get. Seemed like the right thing to do. When I felt the toe of a combat boot in my ribs, and I sort of turned my head and tilted up and looked, and it was the battalion sergeant major, a man 6'3" tall, a big bear of a guy. And he bent over at the waist and sort of yelled down at me so I could just hear him. And what he said shocked me. He said, "Sonny, you can't take no pictures laying down there on the ground." And I thought about that for a minute, and I realized he's right. I can't do my job down here. And the other thing that crossed my mind is I think we're probably all going to be killed, and if that's the case, I'd just as soon take mine standing up anyway. So I got up and went about my business.
What did you shoot?
I was carrying a Nikon camera and an M16 rifle, and on occasion I used them both.
Did your pictures turn out from the battle?
The pictures were... For somebody who was as scared as I was, they weren't too bad.
General, when bombs are falling and there's artillery fire all around and you're under attack, this is the question of somebody who's never served or been in battle. But how do you think clearly? I mean, this is the time when you are most required to think clearly, but when it must be most difficult to do so.
I really have never had any problem. Thinking clearly in a tough, time-critical situation, I think I kind of go into a sort of a C-zone and blank out all the horrible brutality which is going on around me, being aware of it nevertheless, but realizing that I was a commander, I am a commander, and I am responsible for preserving as many American lives as I can and killing as many enemies as I can. Now, in the smoke and the dust, which limits visibility, and the terrible heat, that compounds the situation. The men screaming and yelling, giving orders in three languages, English, Spanish, Vietnamese, wounded men screaming for medics and for their mother about to die. I've never found it difficult to keep my head in situations like that. I'm a paratrooper. I've had a couple of malfunctions. Once I was 8 seconds from hitting the ground, but I knew I'd make it in on my reserve if I could get it open. So I've never really been concerned when I've been in a tough situation. Just do the job.
I guess you can't allow yourself to get too emotional about your men dying in the middle of a fight.
No, you cannot. And furthermore, you cannot impart by your very manner and your voice on the radio any possible sign or word or tone of voice that would indicate to any listener or any of your men looking at you that you were rattled. You had to look cool and be cool, and it's something you can't put on.
What about when the battle's over and you don't have to be cool and you don't have to be unemotional? Does it get you in a different way then?
Yep, that's when it's always hit me. In this battle, I looked around on the ground and saw many of my precious men in their ponchos lying dead, men whom I have trained for 18 months, knew their wives, children, many of them, knew them very closely. And I knew a terrible truth that 24 hours later would shatter the hearts of their families back home in America. And that got to me. Darn right it did. And I never a day goes by in the 27 years since that battle that I don't refight it in my mind and think about those great Americans who never backed off, many of them who had only 7 to 10 days left in the service. And they went home in coffins. And I'm forever grateful for their service, and I grieve for them forever. And for years, I felt guilty that I was not killed. I guess that's a normal reaction from a commander who loves his men.
You don't feel that way anymore?
I've kind of gotten over it a little bit. A few years back, several of my troopers told me at one of these reunions, they said, "Colonel," and they still call me Colonel, which is fine, "Colonel, you guys stop feeling that way, because if you died in that place, none of us would have got out of there." Well, I don't know if that's true or false, but that made me feel better.
We're talking about the Battle of Ia Drang in Vietnam. My guests are Lieutenant General Harold Moore, who led the campaign, and Joseph Galloway, who covered the battle for UPI. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Lieutenant General Harold Moore and journalist Joseph Galloway, and they've collaborated on a book about a battle that General Moore led and Joseph Galloway covered. The book is called We Were Soldiers Once and Young, Ia Drang, the Battle That Changed the War in Vietnam. Now, this battle lasted 4 days and 4 nights. Did you get any sleep at all, either of you, during the length of the battle?
I didn't get any sleep. Along about the early morning of the third day, my mind was still functioning clearly and cleanly and quickly. Do that on adrenaline or just on training and stamina. But the curious thing that happened was that I had to think every word before I would say it into the radio or to people around me. It was like translating English into English, if you can understand what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Joe, did you get any sleep, and were you functioning well?
Well, I was functioning. Sleep sort of leaves your mind. When I'd gone out to that tea plantation, I'd been on the perimeter with one of Colonel Moore's, his Bravo company. And that was foxholes and alarms all night and 100% alert, so I got no sleep that night, and I got no sleep the next night. And I think it was on the last night we were in there, somewhere about 2 o'clock in the morning, it kind of caught up with me. And I remember leaning back against a tree, and the last thing I remember for about an hour and a half until the shooting started again was I remember that same fellow who booted me up onto my feet in the middle of the firestorm. I remember him kneeling down, the sergeant major, and putting a poncho liner over me and tucking me in like I was his son or his grandchild. And I thought, what a tender gesture from such a tough man. And I did. I just conked out. I slept for a couple of hours. I was awakened by the renewed fighting and came up out of the poncho liner and went back to work. Some of that work, I would say, you're not so much a news person in those circumstances as you are of another set of hands.
Mm-hmm.
You can be of use. You can carry the wounded. You can bring water. You can carry ammunition.
Did you carry the wounded?
I did. The one memory that will never leave my mind is what they call a friendly fire incident that occurred on the second day. And we were around the command post, and someone said, "My God, look." And I looked up, and there were two canisters of napalm that had just been released by a U.S. Air Force F-100 jet, and they were coming directly at us. And there was his wingman was behind him and alongside. And if the first set of napalm cans didn't get us, the second were surely going to. And I can remember Colonel Moore screaming, "Get him to pull up, pull up, pull up." And the Charlie Hastings, the Air Force forward controller, on the radio screaming at that pilot. The damage was done with the first two, but we could maybe stop the second plane from dropping his, and Charlie managed to do that. But the other two, just like slow motion, coming down at us, the officer next to me, he knew something I didn't know, that if you are caught in napalm, the one thing you need to do is protect your eyes. And he turned and he put his face into my shoulder and protected his eyes while I just watched them come. And they went just directly over our heads. And they struck in the middle of a couple of small foxholes where our engineer detachment were dug in the grass. And the napalm engulfed them, and we could see them dancing in the fire. And as soon as that napalm died down and we could run out into that smoldering grass, we did. And a man loomed up in the smoke, and he said, "Get this man by his feet." And I reached, and I caught his ankles. And when I did, the nylon of the combat boots crumbled in my hands, and the flesh came off, and I could feel the bones of his ankles in the palms of my hands. And you never ever forget something like that. Those men lay for an hour or so in our little makeshift aid station right beside us, screaming in pain in spite of all the morphine in the world. This affects you. You're no longer you can't be a detached observer in those circumstances. These are people who are giving their lives to save yours.
I'd like to ask you both if during the battle when you probably thought there was a good chance you would die, if you made any bargains with God or made any promises about what you would do if you did live.
I did not. I was very young at the time, just turned 24. I had thought about this myself, and I thought, this is a possibility. But I'd have no wife, I have no children. This is my life I'm risking, and it would cause some pain to my mother and father, but it's worth the risk. Now, I went to war again when I was 49 years old, and I rode with the tanks of the 24th Infantry Division into the Euphrates River Valley deep in Iraq. And that was different. I'm married. I have two young sons, 12 and 15. And all the way across that desert, I thought about them. And I thought about, once again, the young men who were riding with me. And I did do some talking to God on that ride. And what I said was, "God, don't send me back into another Iadrang Valley. I've been there, and these kids don't need to see that."
General, let me ask you if you ever made any bargains with God when you were thinking that this might be the end.
No. You got to remember now that I was a West Point graduate, professional Army officer, trained in all the Army schools. I'd been through battle in the Korean War as an infantry company commander of two infantry companies. And I've seen battle before, and in that war and in the Vietnam War, I never did any bargaining with God. I never thought about my wife and five kids back in America. The thing I thought about was my troopers on the ground and accomplishing my mission, and I never gave a thought in any fight I've ever been in two wars, whether or not I'd get hit. If I got hit, I got hit. That's it. My job was to lead troops, and to lead them, you got to be on the battlefield, and you cannot be fearful. You got to keep your cool, and I never knelt down. It never crossed my mind that we would go down in that fight against great odds. I knew in my heart that we would prevail. We had massive fire support. We had disciplined troops, and we were tough, and we were good. And it never entered my mind to make a personal bargain with God for me or for my men. I knew we'd win.
Did you win?
I think we did. We walked across their bodies by the score on the morning of the third day. We picked up hundreds of weapons, which is, they usually try to get out of there. They bring them all the way down from North Vietnam. They want to keep them. That battlefield was littered with enemy bodies, and he broke contact and headed to the west for his Cambodian base camps. My mind, we won the Battle at LZ X-Ray. He was determined to overrun and kill us all, and he did not do that. I lost 79 killed and 121 men wounded, including my attached units, and that's a terrible price to pay. But he did not kill us all, as he obviously intended to do.
Either of you do anything special on the anniversary of the battle every year?
Oh, you bet. All of the people that we have interviewed in this book, all our friends, our brothers, our comrades, as many of them as possible come here to Washington, and we have a reunion, we have a dinner, we go together to the wall. The names of those who fell in the battles in the Yidrang, 305 of them, are engraved on one single granite panel, the third one to the right of the apex of the Vietnam Memorial. We're older, and some of us are beat up and got gimpy legs, and some of them don't have arms, and some of them are half blind. But we come and we go say something in our hearts to those we left behind.
General, anything you'd like to add to that?
It's a pretty heavy, very profound experience to do so when you see those names on that wall that you knew so well when they were in the prime of their youth, soldiers once and young, and it's tough. But it's also healing, and it's good to be there.
I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you.
Lieutenant General Harold Moore and Joseph Galloway co-wrote the bestseller We Were Soldiers Once and Young, Yidrang, the Battle That Changed the War in Vietnam. Our interview was recorded in November 1992 on the 27th anniversary of the battle. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up on this Memorial Day, a writer who is obsessed with stories told by soldiers who survived Vietnam. Tim O'Brien reads from his book, The Things They Carried, and tells us what he carried with him when he fought in the war. And Maureen Carrigan reviews a novel about World War I called A Very Long Engagement. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Bosnian parliament has begun a session in Sarajevo aimed at consolidating the recent renewal of the alliance between the country's mainly Muslim government and the Bosnian Croats. Both sides have agreed to form a federation, and the parliament is expected to approve a merging of the separate political structures of the two sides. The BBC's Jim Muir reports from Sarajevo.
The Bosnian Muslims and Croats began the war 2 years ago as allies against the Serbs. But last year, that alliance fell apart. There were ferocious bouts of ethnic strife in mixed areas. The Croats pulled out of the Bosnian presidency and set up their own tiny breakaway republic of Herceg Bosna in the west of the country. But since February, the two sides have been moving rapidly back together again, agreeing to reunite in a federal republic in the areas they currently control and others which they hope to regain from the Bosnian Serbs. This session of the Bosnian parliament, into which the Croats have been reintegrated, is expected to approve important decisions already taken at numerous meetings inside and outside the country, aimed at reunifying the political superstructure of the two communities.
Jim Muir reporting. Israel has freed hundreds more Palestinian prisoners. The releases are part of the autonomy accord agreed to by Israel and the PLO. Some 5,000 Palestinians are to be freed gradually. The Israeli army says 6 buses filled with Palestinian prisoners traveled to Gaza and the West Bank today. About 1,300 prisoners have already been let go, but many Palestinians say the releases aren't coming fast enough. The White House is being accused of too much ambition in setting up a free vaccination program for children. Dave Spencer of member station WBGO has this report.
The New York Times says 2 U.S. senators have written the Clinton administration protesting plans to set up a federal government program to give free shots of vaccine to young children to fight childhood diseases. Democrat Dale Bumpers of Arkansas and Republican John Danforth of Missouri say Congress approved only a modest program to make sure low-income children could get the shots. Instead, they say the administration is now planning to gobble up most of the vaccine manufactured in the U.S. and to set up its own federal government warehouse to store the medicine. The senators say the White House is setting up a new entitlement program against the wishes of Congress. Danforth called it simply crazy. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Spencer in New York.
Police in Riverside, California haven't released a motive for yesterday's shooting of the former spokesman of the Nation of Islam. Khalid Abdul Muhammad was wounded in the leg while talking to a group of people outside a hall where he'd just given a speech. Police say the alleged gunman was kicked out of the Nation of Islam 3 years ago. Jewish leaders are denouncing the shooting, but they say Muhammad's message is to blame. Muhammad came to prominence last year after giving a speech that referred to Jews as bloodsuckers. The stock market is closed today. This is NPR. Pope John Paul has written a letter to Roman Catholic bishops addressing the issue of women priests. John Paul has instructed the bishops that the Church has no authority to ordain women. The Pope listed 3 reasons: church tradition, church law, and the fact that Jesus chose only men as apostles. The Pope says women have no lesser dignity than men, but he says the Church will obey God's law. The letter by John Paul is in response to the ordination of women by the Church of England 2 months ago. The Vatican says the ordinations are a serious obstacle to possible unity between the Anglican and Roman Catholic churches. A new poll finds President Clinton's public approval rating has dropped to its lowest point in almost a year. NPR's Laura Kanoy reports.
The Harris poll indicates more people are unhappy with how the president's doing his job. 56% gave him a negative rating in May, compared to 51% in April. Fewer people said they approve of Mr. Clinton's performance, 42% this time compared to 48% in the April survey. President Clinton has had bad poll numbers in the past. Last June, his approval rating was only 35%. Still, the head of the polling company said the recent figures are strikingly low for a period of economic growth. The survey has a margin of error of 3 percentage points. More than 1,200 adults were interviewed nationwide over 3 days last week. This is Laura Kanoy in Washington.
The South Korean government is asking the United States not to resume high-level talks with North Korea. The South wants new conditions set on the talks. Seoul says it wants the North Korean government to first allow full nuclear inspections. North Korea is suspected of diverting fuel from its main reactor to build nuclear weapons. The wife of retired Supreme Court Justice Warren Burger has died. Elvira Burger, who suffered from a heart condition for many years, passed away in her sleep in her Virginia home. She was 84. Mrs. Burger was a former school teacher and a noted amateur watercolorist. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's nothing unusual these days about seeing the Vietnam War depicted in movies, TV programs, and books. Tim O'Brien started writing about the war when the subject was considered too risky to take on. He served in Vietnam in 1968 as an infantryman. In 1973, he published his first book, a memoir, called If I Die in a Combat Zone. In 1979, his novel Going After Cacciato became the surprise winner of a National Book Award. Cacciato was about a soldier who decides he's had enough of the war and takes off for Paris. I spoke with O'Brien in 1990, after the publication of The Things They Carried, a collection of Vietnam stories. In this passage, the narrator is reading a 17-page disjointed letter in which his former combat buddy writes about the problem of finding a meaningful life after the war.
I felt it coming, and near the end of the letter it came. He explained that he had read my first book, If I Die in a Combat Zone, which he liked except for the bleeding-heart political parts. For half a page, he talked about how much the book had meant to him, how it brought back all kinds of memories, the Vils and Paddies and Rivers, and how he recognized most of the characters, including himself, even though almost all the names were changed. Then Bowker came straight out with it. What you should do, Tim, is write a story about a guy who feels like he got zapped over in that shithole. A guy who can't get his act together and just drives around town all day and can't think of any damn place to go and doesn't know how to get there anyway. The guy wants to talk about it, but he can't. If you want, you can use the stuff in this letter, but not my real name, okay? I'd write it myself, except I can't find any words, if you know what I mean, and I can't figure out what exactly to say. Something about the field that night, the way Kiowa just disappeared into the crud. You were there. You can tell it.
Has anything like that actually ever happened to you, getting a letter from a friend or having a friend say to you, you've got to tell my story, I can't do it, but you've got to tell it?
Oh, it's happened hundreds and hundreds of times. I've never taken them up on the offer, and even in this case I didn't. The letter is made up.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that people almost define themselves by maybe a half dozen or a dozen stories that just describe the pivotal incidents in their life?
I do. In my own life, you know, I would say there are a handful, maybe a dozen incidents that are like touchstones that recur over and over in my fiction. There's one incident in the book, in my new book, about the shooting of a baby water buffalo in Vietnam. And the image of a defenseless water buffalo being shot over and over and over again is one that has appeared in, I think, everything I've written, or close to everything I've written. I'm not sure, you know, what the image is there for in terms of symbol or metaphor. Probably nothing. It just has the feel of meat, which was the feel of war. Flesh and blood. Poor baby buffalo being shot over and over and over again. That's senseless, you know. That's war.
Well, in the novel, the person who's shooting the buffalo, the water buffalo, is doing it after he's seen a friend of his die. You know,
yes.
one of his buddies die, and this is interpreted as a kind of not exactly revenge, but venting, some kind of venting of the frustration. Did you witness something like this? Is that why the image keeps recurring in your fiction?
Yeah, I did. I witnessed, we were walking along a paddy dike one day after a horrible, a few hours in a village adjacent to the village of Milai where the massacre happened. We lost several fellows who'd hit landmines. And the platoon was lined up in a long, long row across the paddy dike, and 100 yards away stood a water buffalo. And with no signal, the men began firing. And the buffalo stood there, and you could see gobs of flesh, you know, jumping off the beast. And it stuck.
Were you one of the men who fired?
No. I watched dumbly. I understood it. You can't justify something like that, but there was no enemy to take it out on. Men were feeling sorrow and rage simultaneously, and the buffalo was there to bear the brunt.
Are you as absorbed in the war in actual life as you are in your fiction?
Not at all. Not at all. The war was 20 years old for me. I don't dream about the war. I never have. I don't think about it. The war comes to me only as material for storytelling. I'm obsessed not by Vietnam, not by war, but I'm obsessed by these stories, some of which, I heard, some of which I invent. But it's the story that intrigues me, and the trying to actualize the story through some decent writing.
How vivid are your memories from the war? I mean, how much do you think you remember of, what, the year that you were there?
Oh, a few scattered images. The way if you were to pick up a photographic album and page through it, you'd maybe 7 or 8 pictures would be, there. That would be really vivid. Another 24 or so you'd just vaguely recollect. And the rest of the album is empty. A lot of black pages, which you'd expect, I think, that our memories leave us. But beyond that, a lot of the war was not memorable. Plodding along from village to village, hot days, mosquitoes. It was a kind of monotony to it, but a strange monotony, with boredom with a twist.
What was the twist?
The twist was a kind of like a leaky faucet in your stomach, and I remember instead of water, there was this acid feeling dropping out where you can feel it just eating away inside you. You're bored, frightened simultaneously. Try it sometime. It's tough.
We're listening to an interview recorded with Tim O'Brien in 1990 after the publication of his book, The Things They Carried. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Tim O'Brien is my guest. Your first book, If I Die in a Combat Zone, was really one of the early war memoirs. When did it first come out? Was it 1973?
Yes.
And then Going After Caciato came out a few years later. It was still one of the early Vietnam novels. Was it different for you writing about the war before Vietnam had so penetrated fiction, movies, and television?
I can't say that the output of recent books and movies and so on about the war has helped me or hindered me. I haven't seen many of the movies, and I haven't read many of the books.
I'm surprised to hear that. I thought you'd be curious either to see like what other people were doing with it, or to see if how it compared to your own experiences or your own telling of the experiences.
I think for me at least, I'm not much interested in war stories. Most of them tend to be melodramatic and predictable and bad stories. And I think a lot of readers feel the same. We've been brought up in too many John Wayne movies and too much bad writing. This isn't true just for Vietnam, of course. It's true for, you know, if you look at love stories, look at all those Harlequin romances out there. But nonetheless, there's something about the war story that makes me want to turn my head and move away gently. For me, the war is, that isn't important to me now. What's important to me is language about the war and about the human heart. I was never a very good soldier. I hated that war. And it's now in the distant past. What's in the present for me are the stories that have really, in a way, nothing to do with the war. They're set in the war, but they're stories for me of friendships and ghosts and girlfriends and that kind of thing.
Another image I want to ask you about, and I wasn't sure whether this was literary or actual. There's a sequence, and it's a pretty pivotal sequence where a couple of the characters in your novel are in a field of sewage. Mm-hmm. And the smell just won't go away. I mean, long after they've left, the smell just won't go away.
Mm-hmm.
The literary image there is clear. I was wondering if that was an actual experience, too, if there were fields of sewage like this that you got caught in.
Yeah, I mean, it was meant to be a description of actual things and not as metaphor, not as symbol. It was intended just as stuff, a field full of sewage. That we camped in one night, and we were attacked and mortared, and a man went under.
Man went under the sewage.
Yeah, no metaphor, just under. That smell is still in my dreams. It's the one thing that's really stuck with me. I don't dream Vietnam, but the smell. I don't know if you've ever had an operation that had ether.
Yes,
I did,
yeah.
As a kid.
My tonsils. Getting my tonsils out.
That, you know, that now and then, every 3 years or 8 years, the smell of ether returns to me. It's not set in the hospital. That's a folding feeling in the brain, just the folding over the brain with the smell inside the folds. And that's what returns to me now and then, the smell of that field of sewage folding through my dreams.
What do you think it is that it's the smell that stays with you more than anything else?
That was a pretty terrible smell.
Yeah.
And that's part of it. And part of it is, I'm sure it was linked somehow to the awful thing that happened in the field that night.
Let me ask you about a couple of the images in the book and see where they come from in actuality or your imagination. I mean, what they signify to you. One of the men in the company, Henry Dobbins, is always wrapping his girlfriend's pantyhose around his head. It's his protective magic, his good luck charm.
Mm-hmm.
Did a lot of the men you know have something like that? Did you have anything like that yourself?
No, I didn't. I didn't carry pantyhose, but there were talismans that men carried and wore, and the kind of talismans that touch on peace. The pantyhose business is wrapped around a fellow's neck as a kind of comforter, is a reminder of all that he doesn't have, his girlfriend. Piece that girl represents for him. And, some men carried letters from home, some men carried coins their father made and sent them. A lot of us carried photographs. Some carried lockets of hair.
What were the things that you carried with you to remind you of who you were and what it was that you loved?
I carried odd things. I carried you won't believe this, I carried a book of German grammar. I wanted to learn German while I was in Vietnam.
It seems like such a remote thing.
What an odd thing to be saying, you're Spanish, sprechen Sie Deutsch, and trying to get the accents right and learn the grammatical structures of German after marching all day long through really horrible things. It was a way of, it was a lot of us pushing the war aside, if even for a few moments.
Well, I guess it was also a way of affirming that you had a life of the mind, that there was more besides your body in the war.
Yeah, I think that was a great, great part of it, and a way of just touching on civility and civilization, which for me books represented then and continue to represent. I mean, that's what they are.
What else did you carry?
Oh, gee, I carried so much. I carried cans of orange juice that my father had sent me from Minnesota. These were just precious to me. He sent me 12 cans, and they were heavy. And it wasn't the orange juice I craved. It was the fact that these cans of orange juice had come from my dad from so far away. And I gave myself 1 month for each can. One can a month.
So you measured your whole tour of duty by those cans?
By those cans of orange juice.
Tim O'Brien. Our interview was recorded in 1990, after the publication of his book, The Things They Carried. His next book is scheduled for publication this fall. Fresh Air.
Hello, this is Noah Adams in Washington with a word about what's coming up on All Things Considered. I'll talk with Mark Doyle in Kigali, Rwanda, about the problems of establishing a ceasefire between the government forces and the rebel troops there. Mara Liasson reports on how President Clinton's Memorial Day went. He made two speeches. Martha Raddatz reports on two examples of U.S. military tragedies in Mogadishu, Somalia, and in Iraq. I'll have a conversation with Larry LeSueur, a CBS radio correspondent who went ashore at Utah Beach 50 years ago during the D-Day invasion of northern France. Also, Bob Mondello has a rundown of summer movies. That and more coming up later on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
On this Memorial Day, Maureen Corrigan has a book to recommend about World War I called A Very Long Engagement by Sébastien Yaprissot. It was an immediate bestseller in France when it was published there in 1991. It was recently translated into English, and Maureen warns that once you start reading it, you'd better be prepared to cancel all other plans for the next couple of days.
In Milan Kundera's novel, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, there's a scene at a cocktail party where a woman lectures to her fellow guests about the two categories of literature. She says, "There are books meant for daytime reading and books that can be read only at night." I recalled that scene almost as soon as I began A Very Long Engagement. This is, without a doubt, the kind of pensive, heartbreaking book you should save for a sleepless night, when the only distractions will be the sound of your own breathing and, most probably, the solitary embarrassment of a few tears. Sébastien Yaprissot's novel is a murder mystery, a fierce love story, and a vivid portrait of France during and after World War I. Its atmosphere is gothic and dreamy, all quiet on the Western Front crossed with Wuthering Heights. The story opens on the snowy evening of January 6th, 1917. French soldiers are marching five of their own men, prisoners, through the trenches. These men have been condemned for trying to invalid themselves out of the war by shooting their own hands. At the end of the last trench, the prisoners are thrown over the top into no man's land. We learn the former civilian identities of the five men as they disappear into the night. There's a carpenter nicknamed the Eskimo, a radical trade unionist, a taciturn farmer known only as That Man, a pimp named Angel, and a shell-shocked 19-year-old named Manek. By the following morning, their five corpses will lie scattered over the wasteland, and that should be the end of the whole shameful episode. But Manek's fiancée, a 17-year-old named Mathilde, won't rest until she satisfies her agonizing curiosity about his exact fate. Here's how Yaprissot lyrically describes Mathilde's quest for the truth. A wire snaked its way through all the trenches. Mathilde has seized hold of it. It guides her into the labyrinth from which Manek has not returned. She never loses heart. She tells herself that if this wire does not lead her back to her lover, that's all right. She can always use it to hang herself. Mathilde is an astonishing creation. She's cunning and bossy, and although she's been confined to a wheelchair since childhood, she travels all over France to interview comrades and relatives of the dead men. Through letters, lies, and flashbacks, Yaprasso gives distinctive voices here to a battalion of characters. He's also adept at slow-motion suspense. In the early months of Mathilde's investigation, she learns the five soldiers lived for hours during that night in no man's land. Manek even built a snowman out there. Over the next few years, she collects odd clues about their deaths: a pair of boots, a lost glove, encoded letters. And as her search draws to a close, Mathilde crosses into the twilight world of the dead to learn the truth from a soul in torment. If that's too metaphorical a plot summary for you, the plain English explanation is, I don't want to give away the surprise ending. The usual compliment to pay a great novel is to say, I couldn't put it down. But a very long engagement was so terribly moving, sometimes I just had to.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed A Very Long Engagement. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Nancy Greenlease and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Mary Previty returns to our program to tell us more about running a New Jersey detention center where teenagers accused of murder, drug dealing, prostitution, and other crimes await trial. Under her leadership, the center has become a model for helping young people who are in trouble. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.